Valley Group honors this tradition by rigorously searching for the finest recovery speakers in the Western Hemisphere so that they can share their experience, strength, and hope with us. Each week, we recognize one of these speakers for their service to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is now time to recognize Valley Group's Outstanding Speaker of the Week. The nominee for this category has a sobriety date of 4/28/90. He has been continuously in service as a secretary and sponsor. And I just found out tonight, since 1990, he has secretaried an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting for at least half a year, every single one of those years. When he says continuously in service, that's what he means. And his AA motto is, the newcomer is the most important person in the room. May I have the envelope, please? So exciting. The winner of the Outstanding Speaker of the Week is Javier V. from Fresno.
You guys are crazy. All right. Hi, I'm Javier. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Oh, well, I have to, this is a rigorously honest program, and I explained to Mark that I've been a secretary for a six-month period. Out of the time I've been sober, there's been a couple of years, I think maybe 2 years, that I didn't do a secretaryship. But for the most part, I think it was like for my first 18 years, every 6 months, once a year, I would take on a commitment halfway through the year, and I would take it into my AA birthday, and that was taught to me in my first 6 months of sobriety. I took the secretaryship, and I wrote it right into my one-year AA birthday, and then I gave it up, and then when October rolled around again, I would take it again, and I did that every year. I was always in a service commitment, and I think that's probably one of the reasons. I don't know which reason exactly it is that has kept me sober these years, but it would be one of the things that has helped me. And but I wanted to just clarify that. I want to thank Mark and also thank Phil, and really I wouldn't be here tonight had it not been for Kirk W. because I came in January to listen to him speak. You know, he had just celebrated his one-year birthday, and they asked him to speak here in Visalia, and so a few of us friends came here to listen to him share the meeting, and it was a great meeting. And there was a lot of speculation about a guy with 1 year sobriety leading a big meeting like this, and you know, he pulled it off, and afterwards I let him know that he was the best 1 year speaker since Bill W. himself. So I just wanted to remind him about that. And this is special tonight for me because I didn't know that Robert was going to be here, the pointer. I didn't know what the pointer meant. He told me he was going to be pointer tonight, and so both Robert and Kirk are men that I had the privilege of sponsoring at one time in Fresno, and so I'm really grateful for that and for how they've affected my life. And you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I got here when I was 23 years old, and you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous the first time, you know, and I came into the Triangle Club in Pomona, California. And I remember being inside that meeting and thinking to myself, there was a point where I realized, because I had no exposure to AA before, I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was about. But I can remember being in the meetings and probably being there like maybe 3 days in a row at the 6:30 a.m. meeting. And I remember there came a point when it dawned on me that you people in Alcoholics Anonymous were talking about staying sober for the rest of your lives. And I thought to myself, there is no fucking way that I'm going to be able to stay sober for the rest of my life. Because I thought there were so many things that still had to be done where I was going to be drinking. And all I wanted to do was just stop shaking. And that's why I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous, was because I was going through really super bad withdrawals. And the withdrawals that I had were so hard on me that I ended up in a hospital in Upland, California. Let me go back a little bit. I'll go to my drinking. I grew up in Faribault. I don't know if you guys know where Faribault is at. And Faribault, if you're from Faribault, you know that that's where the hell is. And that's how we grew up. And, I didn't drink in houses. I didn't drink at house parties. We drank at the Delta Mendota, Snake Road, alongside the river. There was just all these different Tea Road party spots, and that's where we partied at. And the thing about growing up over there, and I'm sure it's that way everywhere, but you just grew up thinking that you were just going to drink, you were just going to party, and I was not going to be that way. And the reason why I wasn't going to be that way is because I grew up with a father that was a heroin addict, and the childhood that I lived with my father, with who he was one of constant chaos. And I grew up seeing a lot of things that a kid shouldn't probably see. And I grew up loving my father and knowing that he was the heroin addict, and everybody in the town knew it. And kids that I went to school with, they knew it, and they would tell me, and I was very embarrassed, but I still love my father, but there was a lot of sadness, and I had a grandmother who loved me a lot, and my grandmother was kind of like my mom to me. And we lived on her property. And there was a day when I'd seen my father with another woman in town. And I went home and I told my grandma. I was like 12 years old. And I didn't know that that when he got home that day that she was going to kick him off the property. And that's what happened. She locked him out. She told him off. It was a big dramatic scene, and I saw it. And then when my mom got home, my mom was pissed off at me. And then that was the last day that I lived with my father. So my father ended up leaving for Modesto, and then my mom ended up following him. And then she left me and my brother, my 8-year-old brother. And my brother Eddie, basically just cried his eyes out for days. And I felt really guilty because I thought that I had I torn my family apart. And I carried that guilt for a long time. And I was really sad. And I felt really uncomfortable with myself. And somehow it was right around that time I started to notice all the uncomfortabilities that I had with people and with other kids, and just feeling like I was just feeling different. And that started the whole process of me trying to get away from myself. And that was before I ever took a drink. I wasn't going to take a drink or do any of that stuff because my grandmother told me that, you're going to end up just like your father, and I never wanted to be like him, so I would never do that. And so what I did is I did the opposite. I was a goody two-shoes. And I went to church. I sang in the choir. I did all these things to make people, love me. And, I still had that emptiness. No matter what I did, I always had the emptiness inside me. And, I did my first geographic freshman year in high school. I I was doing very poorly in school, and I told my grandparents, hey, send me to San Joaquin Memorial in Fresno. I'll be okay there. That's where the kids that I went to school with, they ended up at San Joaquin Memorial, so I thought if I got over there, I'd be better. And I got to San Joaquin Memorial, and it wasn't any better. I was still the same kid who was still missing something and still feeling horrible about myself. No matter where I was at, that's how I felt. And so I ended up my junior year. So it was my junior year of high school that I had my first drink. And actually, I had a first drink my freshman year. I had a couple of slugs of peppermint schnapps. But it wasn't anything to even give me a buzz, and I don't know what I was doing, and I wasn't trying to catch a buzz, and so I don't even really count that as my first drink. But my first drink really was with some popular kids, some jocks, and I ended up at a party with them, and they had Budweiser beer, and this guy David gave me this Budweiser beer, and I had it in my hand, and I started to drink it with him, and I'd say probably about three quarters of the way through the beer, I started to feel like I was going to throw up. And I told Dave, hey man, I feel like I'm going to throw up. And Dave said, Javier, just burp and fart and you won't throw up. So I started burping and farting with Dave, and I made my first drinking friend. And I drank like three beers that night, and I remember feeling like I got that little buzz, and I really liked it, and I couldn't wait to do it again. And I think it might have been a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of weeks later. I think I drank with them like three or four times before my junior year was out. And then that year, my grandfather told me, he said, Javi, we can't afford to keep you in at Memorial anymore. You're going to have to come back to Faribault. And so when I went back to Faribault, I really, really was not looking forward to going back to Faribault. And so when I went back, I went back with this whole change of identity of who I was. See, the people in Faribault, the kids I grew up with, they looked at me as the goody-two-shoes choir boy kid that used to get picked on all the time. But when I came back from San Joaquin Memorial, which is also goody-two-shoes stuff, Catholic school, when I came back, I shaved my head and I changed my wardrobe. And I pretended that I had been a punk rocker the whole time I was in Fresno, which was a lie. So you see, I have this way of doing things in order to make myself feel comfortable with who I am. And I had to do that in order to put off this facade to them, so that way they wouldn't really know who I was anymore, and they would think I was someone different. And so then that way I could then turn around and justify the way that I drank. And then I started drinking more. And the first time I drank with those guys, I drank like a six-pack. And then, like, the second time I drank with them, I drank like eight or nine. And then by the third time, I kept counting. I'm a counter. And so I kept counting. And heck, I was getting up to 10 and 11. And these guys, they thought that was really cool. And they weren't drinking as much as I was drinking. And I found that there was some power in that. There was some power in that I had never experienced before. All of a sudden, these guys started to look up to me. And I never, ever had anybody ever look up to me before. And so all of a sudden, I'm starting to feel really good about the fact that these guys are looking up to me. And so I started to figure out ways to drink more. And what happened for me was that drinking became my sport. I started learning everything I could about drinking. And I started drinking more. And I would figure out who's the person that drinks the most, and I would try to keep up with them and then drink more than them. And I started to find out that I had a high tolerance for drinking. 12, 13, 14 beers before I'd ever start to feel like I had to throw up. And then what I started to learn how to do is I started to learn how to throw myself up. I'd take these two fingers, I'd go relieve myself, and then I would come back and drink more. And then I could hit 17, 18, 19 beers. And this stuff all happened within my first, like, 4, 5, 6 months of drinking. And, I just started to become very good at it. And then I started to teach all the dudes I was drinking with. I started teaching them how to do it. And then once I started to develop my crew. And and we would all drink about the same amount, and then we'd all go relieve ourselves, we'd come back, and then we just start pounding down the rest of the beer that was there, and the other guys that were having the parties, you know, they were supplying the booze, they were tripping out on us, but we didn't tell anybody about our little secret, about 5-6 of us. And, you know, and that's what gave me, like, a sense of being somebody. You know, isn't that crazy? That gave me a sense of, like, of just being cool. And, you know, it was cool. And then I noticed the girls talked to me a little bit more. And then I noticed I was able to talk to them a little bit easier. And so that's just the way it just started happening for me. And, but what happened was that by the end of my senior year, all the people, you know, I really, really, really wanted to be friends with people. And I really wanted to feel like I was a part of. But the way that I drank, you know, it started to become evident with, you know, Fargo's not a big place. And the kids, their parents started to find out about, you know, about me somehow. Because what started happening is that kids stopped wanting to hang around with myself and other guys that I hung around with because of the way that I drank. And it was pointed out to me by my friend that, you know, I tried so hard to get this guy as a good friend. He became my best friend. And at the end of my senior year, I didn't give a shit whether he was my friend or not anymore. And in fact, he told me, Javier, man, people are starting to lump me up with you. And, you know, and they don't want their kids hanging around with me because, you know, I hang around with you. And, you know, maybe we just need to slow down a little bit. And I said, Gary, man, I thought you were my buddy. Thought you were my best friend, man. I don't really give a shit what those people say. And you know what? If you want to go with them, then go with them. I don't give a shit. You know, and that is what happened for me was that, you know, it all of a sudden, you know, what I did was now of the most importance to me. It was not, you know, I didn't really care how it was affecting anybody else. And, you know, my senior year, I almost didn't graduate, and that was because I lost control one night, which I lost control a lot. I cracked up. I don't know if you ever hear people talk about blackouts, you know, I crack up when they tell you all about the blackout. And I'm sorry if you're one of those people, but you know what? When I blacked out, I didn't really remember what happened. I was told what happened, and a lot of things I couldn't believe it, like taking keys and scratching up this badass dude in town's car. You know, and then running, you know, making sure I don't run into the guy, you know, for months afterwards. And, you know, and my friends told me about it. My friends told me all the things that I did. You know, and, the one thing that, happened to me where I got in trouble my senior year right before graduation was that I didn't get to go to grad night. And so I got pissed off and I started drinking that night. And I can remember being at getting drunk throughout the day, remembering being at the high school at nighttime, and then not remembering. But somehow getting home, not remembering how I got home, getting home, and then the next day when I came to, seeing all these scratches all over my body, and then thinking I was at the school, so I went back to the school. And then I looked around and I saw, you know, all these little trees were all snapped in half in the quad in the middle of the school. There was probably about maybe 10 trees snapped in half. And I, you know, and I knew that I had done it because I had had a history of snapping little trees when I drink. You know, I would pretend I was a football player, which I wasn't, and I would tackle the tree, snap it in half. And people had seen me do that before. So when I got to school on Monday, there was a reward for, you know, the vandalism, and you know, by the second period, people were walking by me saying, it was you, right, Javier, it was you, you did that, didn't you? And by third period, I couldn't take it, so I went and turned myself in. And and the principal, Jack Duren, he told me he was going to let me graduate. He wasn't going to suspend me, but I told him that I had a problem with drinking and I was drunk that night. And he sent me to counseling, and then my mom had to pay for the trees. And so I started going to counseling and, once a week, and every week I went, the counselor would ask me why I drank, and I would tell her that it was because of my father. And then I would just go on to just blast my father, just blast him. And I would say all the mean things about my father and about how he stole from us and, you know, stole our Christmas presents, stole our jackets, stole all of our furniture. And I would just go on and on and on about my dad. Nothing about my drinking, all about what he did to me. And this went on. And then like maybe the third or the fourth time, they had my dad come from Calexico. They brought him, surprise visit, and my mom was there and my grandmother were there. And the counselor, you know, asked me, so Javier, will you tell us, you know, why you drink? And so then I proceeded to just told him off for the first time ever. And I was so angry, and I just got to lay it on him. And when I was done, he looked at me and he said, Javi, he goes, I know that I was a bad father to you. And he goes, but I didn't, you know, leave you, you know, without a house. Your grandparents take good care of you. He said, but I don't ever remember taking a beer and putting it up to your mouth and making you drink it, or putting marijuana up to your mouth and making you smoke it, or cocaine to your nose and make you snort it. You did those things because you like the way it makes you feel. I know. I do the same thing. And when he said that to me, it was like he took my excuse right there, right from me. And in front of my grandmother and in front of my mom and in front of the counselor. There was nothing I could say. I couldn't come back at it. But I could tell you that was my defining moment of when I started to even drink harder. And I can remember that right at that point, I hated him so much that I even drank at him more. You know, I ended up, I graduated and I made it to Fresno, and there's a whole bunch of stuff that I'd love to tell you about. One thing I'll tell you is that my throwing up, you know, how I used to do this. And when I felt full, as I got a little older, once I hit, 20, about 20 years old, it didn't matter, when I drank. It didn't matter if it was the first beer, the third beer, the fifth beer, the eighth beer. I could never know when it was going to come up. It just came up. And I remember the first time it ever happened, I was walking in an alley and it came up, and I was lucky I was in an alley. But there was, I could never judge it anymore after that. So that's kind of like when I started doing a lot of combinations. I started really getting into combinations. And I think you guys know about combinations. I was one of those guys. And I searched for the perfect buzz that would last for as long as it could last. And that's what I did. And I ended up moving to, I got a job with this one company, Household Finance. I got it when I was 20. They moved me to Southern California. That's how I got sober in Pomona. And when I got there, that's when it got worse, when my drinking got worse. And I started to explain to you that I got it to the San Antonio Hospital because of, my withdrawals. And really what those were for me was I couldn't drink every day. I didn't have the money to do it every day. And it seemed like somewhere around like 3 in the afternoon is when they would start to hit me. And I'd be at work and I would start getting real agitated. And I would start feeling kind of shaky. And it would be a combination of things that I start to feel like my heart beating really fast. And then I start to get these tingling sensations at the back of my neck and the back of my head, and I would start sweating, and I would just start getting really paranoid, and at 5 o'clock I'd get in the car and I'd get driving, and I passed the Pomona Fairgrounds, and there was a 7-Eleven on the corner of Foothill Boulevard and White, and that 7-Eleven I'd buy a 6-pack of Tall Can Buds and a Big Gulp. And one can of Tall Can Bud fits perfectly in a Big Gulp. And then I would sip them all the way home, which is about a 45-minute drive, in L.A. stop-and-go traffic all the way home. And I'd finish that six-pack, and I'd get home, and I'd drink a little bit of tequila, and I'd smoke a little weed, and that's how I did it. But there were the days that I couldn't do that. And those days that I couldn't do it, I just had to live with those shakes that I was getting. And this one particular day, I thought that I was actually having a heart attack. And so that's why I went to the Upland Hospital. And they hooked me all up and checked me out, and they said to me that there was nothing wrong with me. They said, you're okay. And they sent me on my way. They, you're not having a heart attack or a stroke. You're okay. There's nothing wrong with you. And then the next day, the same thing happened to me. Same time, and it's hitting me hard. I'm driving home. It's hitting me really bad. I go right back to the same hospital, same nurse, same emergency doctor, and same thing. You know, there's nothing wrong with you. But the doctor wants me to ask you, how do you drink? And so for the first time in my life, I told the truth. And I told this nurse exactly how I drank. And I told her everything that I did. And she said to me, the doctor says that it sounds like you're going through withdrawals. You should get in touch with Alcoholics Anonymous. They can help you there. And so that's how I got in touch with Alcoholics Anonymous. And they sent me on my way to work to the Triangle Club in Pomona at the 6:30 a.m. meeting that I described earlier. And so I went to those meetings there. And I was probably a lot like a lot of you guys that are here today. I didn't want to be there. I just want to stop shaking. And in our big book, it talks about I was full of fear of what the booze was doing to me. But fear of what alcohol does to you is not enough to keep you sober. It's enough to maybe give you a start, but it's not enough to keep you, because we forget. And that's what the big book talks about, is that we forget. And what happened is that after I started coming to meetings, I started to feel better. I started coming every day. And despite myself, I started to get sober. And I say despite myself because I'm the kind of guy that when I got to the meeting, I got there right when the meeting started. And as soon as the meeting was over, I was the first one out the door. Never once did I take any time to say hello to anybody. I didn't want to know anybody. I didn't want to make friends. I don't want to get your phone number. And I didn't want to make you find out about a sponsor. I don't want anybody telling me what to do. I didn't want to learn about God. I already had my conception of God. I didn't want to talk about God. I didn't want to do any of that. All I wanted to do was stop shaking. And just by showing up to the meetings and sticking around, I stopped shaking. And it took me about a couple of months. I was there from the beginning of January through the month of February, and sometime in the month of March, I had this this realization one day that I was okay, that I felt okay, that I was feeling healthy, that I wasn't feeling shaky anymore. I was feeling good. And then my brain started to tell me, look at all these fucking people. They're sick. I mean, look at them. They're old. They look stinky. Look at them. They're ugly. They're low bottom. I mean, look at you. You're in a suit. Look at you. You got a good job. You're not like these fucking people. Look at them. That is your alcoholism. The ism separates us, wants to separate us from the pack. And the ism is right here. It's in between your ears. It's in your brain. That's where it's centered at. And not once did I say, hey, this is what I'm thinking. Hey, I'm thinking about this. Can you guys help me? Not once. I kept it in. And then I started thinking, I'm going to drink again because, I wasn't really that bad. I just had some bad luck. I'm going to prove I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not like these people. I'm going to prove that I'm not an alcoholic. And so what I did was I planned my drink. And I was sitting in meetings for a couple of weeks thinking about drinking and never once said anything. Started planning the drink. Talked about it with my wife. Said to her, hey, I'm going to go back to Fresno. From Pomona to Fresno, I'm going to go back to Fresno. I'm going to drink a six-pack, and I'm not going to have another drink until my birthday on May 23rd. And that night when we got to Fresno and I drank, I can remember having the beer in my hand and thinking to myself, should I do it or shouldn't I? Should I or shouldn't I? And I held that beer for probably a full minute. That's a long time to hold a beer. That's about the amount of time we were meditating earlier, about a minute. By the way, when we were meditating, I was thinking, damn, that's a long minute. But that beer was in my hand for a minute, and it was peeling, and it was cold, and it was frothy, and And at that point, I had no defense against that drink. No defense. Nothing could save me from it. And I said, fuck it. And I downed it. And I didn't drink six. I drank 18, 19 shots. Same as always. But the one thing that I didn't do is the next morning, I didn't drink the morning drink. And that is what I used to do to get over my shakes in the morning, is I would drink in the morning red beers. And I was doing that from the time I was like 19 years old. So when I crack up when old timers say, you know, oh, you got sober when you were 23, yeah, but you listen to how I freaking drank and you can understand, you know, I drank to wake up, you know, and to get over those shakes, you know, to get over that crudo and to just start feeling it again. And, you know, it's better to get over a hangover with a buzz. And that's the way I did it. And I was not going to do that next morning. I was not going to do it. I willed myself to not drink that next morning. And it was the hardest day of my life because I wanted to drink so badly. Because I knew the thing that I do remember from those morning meetings is there was somebody that said if you were truly an alcoholic and you start drinking again, your symptoms are going to get worse. And those withdrawals I experienced that morning were harder than the ones that sent me into the emergency room. They were harder. And I wanted to drink so badly. But I knew I couldn't because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. So I willed myself through that day. And I made it back to Pomona. And within a couple of days, I was drunk again. And so hence my birthday, April the 28th, not May the 23rd. My sobriety date is April the 28th, 1990. I drank from around March the 5th or 6th, somewhere in that neighborhood. I don't know the exact date, till April the 28th. And in that time period, alcohol proved to me that I was an alcoholic. I got to really see my alcoholism. There's so many stories I could tell you that led up to the end. But really the bottom line is I finally got to the point where I surrendered. And surrender is the most important part of this program. You have to surrender. And if you don't know what surrender is, I didn't know what surrender was either. But the day came when I woke up in the morning and I knew that I needed to call in sick to work. And I thought about calling in sick, and then I thought to myself, I'm out of booze. And then I thought, I got to go to the store. And then I thought, God help me. And that's when I surrendered. But I didn't know that's when I surrendered. But I was so sincere, I was so desperate, and I was so, I meant it so much when I said, God help me. And it was as though, the hand of God just reached down and grabbed me and pulled me up. It's like he just pulled me right out of there and put a thought into my mind. Isn't there a phone number you can call from work? And I called it. And then they sent me to the Pomona Valley Hospital. My insurance was covered with them. And then I went there. And then I went to go see my boss. And I told him, hey, it's a 28-day program. I went to AA before. They couldn't help me. And he says, go take care of yourself, Javier. You'll have your job when you get back. And I got in my car and I drove home and I cried my eyes out because I thought my life was over. And so I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and how I got into AA was that treatment center made me go to a meeting at 6:30 every morning in the treatment facility and one at 7 o'clock at night, and they gave me a big book. And, 28-day program, two meetings and a big book, and then all their treatment in between. And, God bless them and their treatment, but, the guys that saved my life were the men in the meetings at that 6:30 a.m. meeting. And I said that tonight I was going to mention their names. And the man that became my sponsor was a guy named Gilbert. And Gilbert said that it didn't matter how far down the road that you had gone, that if you asked God back in your life, he would take you back. And when he said that, it was as though he was talking right to my heart. And I welled up just like I am right now. And I knew that I was going to be okay. And afterwards, I went up to him and I asked him to be my sponsor. And he said, I'll be your sponsor, but you need to call me every day. And I said, I will. And you need to read the first 164 pages of the big book. And I said, I will. And I've been doing everything that those guys told me to do ever since then. When I said that, I don't know what it is that I've done right. It's because I do a lot of things. And I don't know which one, the one that's keeping me sober. But I've been doing them for a very long time and I keep doing them. And that's how I know if somebody wants to get sober or not. If a newcomer is willing to go to any lengths, the same way they went to any lengths to get messed up, then they'll go to any lengths to stay sober. I mean, all you got to do is switch it. You just got to go after sobriety the way you went after your booze or the way you went after your drugs. You got to go at it with everything that you got, because I know that all you guys had to go after it with everything that you had. I know that I went after it with everything that I had. I did so much bullshit to people. I conned so many people. I did so many things in order to be able to get what I wanted. And then to do it sober, you know, to just do these simple things that they tell you to do. Will you do it? Will you do it? Will you do it with a chance to have a life? You know, I didn't know. But I knew I surrendered. And I was willing to go ahead and do what they told me to do. And I had no idea what was going to happen, but I started to just do what they told me to do. And then I started to see people die. First 30 days, I saw a dude say that he was going to blow his brains out, and then he did. And everybody tried to save him, and nobody could save him. And then my sponsor told me, better him than you, Javier. Better him than us. You know, because it's a deadly disease. And then finally I realized, oh shit, they're not kidding about it. And then I saw another person die, and then I saw another person die. I can't tell you how many people I've seen die in the program, and some guys that almost died. And, you know, I could have been one of those guys. And, you know, so I just kept doing what they told me to do, and I just followed their lead. And Gilbert was one. Carmen was the other one. Carmen was the old-timer that used to beat me up verbally. He used to tell me shit like, take the cotton out of your ears, stick it in your mouth. You don't know shit. Shut the fuck up. We don't want to hear from you. You ain't got nothing to share. Get away from me. You're going to be drunk in 30 days. I don't want what you've got. and then I would go crying to my sponsor, and my sponsor said, hey, he's right. Javier, man, you think you know everything. You want to comment on everything that everybody shares. You know, it's just be quiet and just listen. And if you got a burning desire, come talk to me about it. You know, and that's what I started to do. I started learning how to do that. You know, and then I started working the steps with those guys. And Poncho the Wino, you know, if anybody ever said that they didn't make it to the gutter, he'd say, hey, watch it. Because he was a gutter train jumper, Poncho the Wino. You know, and there was Big Book Mac, who could cite verse and chapter out of the Big Book on any problem that you had. You know, and I could just go on and on. There was Deep that always gave you a big hug and told you that he loved you. And then the guys, Gabriel and Walter and Steve Twigg, the dudes that taught me how to play golf so that way I could play golf with the people that I worked with. You know, and then they all helped me when I didn't have a car, and they rode me to meetings and then rode me for the meetings to my work. You know, and then they helped me move when I got my promotion and I moved to San Jose, and they all filled up my U-Haul truck. You know, and, you know, I'm forever grateful to those men. You know, some of them are dead. Some of them are still alive. But they're just the beginning, because I got sober and I moved to San Jose. I moved to Fresno. And, you know, I've had a really, really super rich, rich life. I'm going to just tell you that I have three children that are ages it'll be 21, 20, and 17, and my kids have never seen me drink. And I'm really grateful for that. I'm not happy about some of the things they saw me do in sobriety, because I'm not an angel. And but they never seen me drink. And I've been able to still be parts of their lives. And the other thing I want to share is that I was able to finally, you know, make amends with my father and apologize to him. And through the process of doing the fourth step, being able to let him know that it wasn't his fault that I did the things that I did, that it was my fault, that he was right, that I did that because I liked the way it made me feel and it had nothing to do with him. And that I knew that he did the best that he could. And I let him know what I was grateful for the ways that he influenced my life positively. And that I was making an apology to him for making him my scapegoat. And that, and when I told him that, you know, he said to me, Javi, I wish I could be half the man that you are. I love you, son. And he gave me a hug. It was the first time I'd ever heard him tell me that he loved me. And he was high that day. And then when I was 7 years sober, he got sober. And so my father has been sober for about 15 years. But he got sober through Victory Outreach. He's a Bible-thumping, Jesus-loving Christian. But man, he does it. You know, he don't mess around, man. He does it. The same way I do the programming, he does that. You know, and our big book says that, you know, that we don't own the whole sobriety thing, that there's many ways to get it. But I'll tell you what, I'd rather do it this way. And I could keep going on and on and on. I really, really, really love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been really good to me. I'm at the Rule 62 Men's Stag on Thursday nights, and I'm usually at the Sierra Fellowship Men's Stag on Saturday mornings. But my home group is North Park also. And I'm really, really grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a life that I couldn't believe that I have. Even with all the ups and downs, it is better than the way it was before, because I know I was on my way to being, you know, dead. So I'm really grateful. Thank you.